Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Parliament has voted and it has said no to no deal, no also to any sort of deal, no to extending Article 50, and no to even thinking about allocating any time to talking about any of it. No, 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 no. British politicians are 2-year-olds shouting no at everything because they can, and they haven't got a clue what they want, and they seem unaware that they've just missed out on ice cream. Prime Minister and frostbitten bollard Theresa May spent over 2 years working on a deal, or at least a few weeks of that 2 years, persuading everyone to like it and warning of the consequences of voting against it. Only to then, on Tuesday, vote against it herself and promise to go back to the EU with loads of asks that they've already said no to. Every single time I think we've hit peak stupid, Theresa May climbs up there with sandals on and adds scaffolding which she hasn't got all the parts for or any idea how it should be assembled. Do you know that old joke about the duck who keeps going to the butcher's or bar or whatever variant you've heard and repeatedly asks if they've got any wood? Do you know that? The duck goes up to barman and says, got any wood? And the barman says, no, this is a pub. And he comes back in next day and says, got any wood? And the barman says, no, it's a pub. And next day he comes in and says, got any wood? And the barman says, if you ask me that again, I'll nail your feet to the floor. And next day the duck comes in and says, have you got any nails? And the barman says, nails? No. And then the duck says, you got any wood? Right, that duck is Theresa May. Just without the wherewithal to ask if the barman has any nails at the end, or if she did, it wouldn't be out of some smarts, it'd only be because she'd already been told they didn't. There is nothing about what's happened that makes sense unless you understand that it's more important to Conservatives to survive as a party than for the country to do well. It's either that or they're a special sort of vampire that only feeds off misery and have a really big feast planned for later this year. The Brexit debate leading to Tuesday night could again have been replaced with the noise of a horse kicking a dustbin full of old brass instruments. At one point, Conservative MP and the worst of Harry Enfield's characters, Oliver Letwin, said that he is past caring what the deal is. And a lot of people got very angry, but I think that that's the first time I've ever heard a Conservative MP entirely in tune with the public. Brexit secretary and man who is to politics what Tab Clear was to fizzy drinks, Stephen Barclay, said that one of the amendments was an empty vessel, a Trojan horse. Now, either he doesn't remotely know his Greek mythology, or he blames his own dysfunctional genitals and some condoms he once bought, you know, like a bad workman might. Most of the potentially useful amendments were rejected due to the Conservative and DUP majority in Parliament, combined with a handful of Labour MPs who still think the best way to get Tory voters on side is to have them so confused at the ballot box as to which candidate is which. Only 14 Conservatives voted for the Yvette Cooper and Dominic Grieve amendments, one of which was to extend Article 50, another which is mainly just to have more time to talk about all these things, and it was only 14 Conservatives because Tory rebel is a term that is a paradox and therefore can't exist. You know, like compassionate conservatism, affordable housing, or James Cleverly. Somewhere in the depths of the universe, in a place where space and time warp and things happen that shouldn't, several bizarro Tory rebels are enjoying an alternative no-deal Brexit that was successful, while listening and actually gaining enrichment from something A. Piers Morgan says. But if you have a minority, how do you defeat a powerful majority? I was trying to think of historical examples of that happening, but realised having Labour SNP and the Lib Dem MPs dressed as Gerard Butler from 300 really won't help matters, and if anything, will probably make it worse. The Conservatives had all joined together because of the Malthouse Compromise, which sounds like something weird happened when they all had a sleepover and drank too much Ovaltine, and now they're sworn to secrecy. But actually, it was an agreement to all back a plan that doesn't make much sense as a plan. So yes, I guess the too much Ovaltine thing still very much works. So Corbyn's amendment was rejected, Blackford's amendment and Cooper's and Greaves, even though, as I said, that was just about allocating time to discuss Brexit. So voting against it seemed to be just rebelling against having to even be there to vote on it. The only two that did pass were Spelman's amendment to avoid a no deal, which can't actually happen, and that was an advisory amendment anyway, so people won't take notice in the first place. And Brady's amendment for May to seek alternatives to the Northern Irish backstop, which can't be done unless May is going to rename it a Northern Irish palisade. Labour leader and sentient eyebrow Jeremy Corbyn has said that he'll now speak to May after Parliament voted to avoid a no deal, even though that doesn't mean that it's off the table, and in fact all the other votes against all the other amendments mean that it really still is very much there and is kind of like a main course with those big silver dishes over the top of it to keep it hot. Today he told Sky News that it's wrong that the UK can't unilaterally stop a backstop that they voted for and put in place as a failsafe in case they don't find a solution. So there's a Prime Minister who's going to Europe to tell people she wants things that they've already said she can't have, and an opposition leader who's agreeing to meet with May because of something that isn't happening and is criticising things that are only put in place because no one else has any ideas. Seriously, has there been a deadly gas leak at Parliament? Are we going to find out in 10 years' time that they're all slowly getting mercury poisoning every single time they drank anything in the bar? I'm starting to wonder if the best plan of action is none of this debates or talks or second votes. It's just for someone else who can prove that they've read at least one thing and won't touch a metal pipe if they've been warned it's hot, just declares themselves as leader and we unilaterally as a country let them have a go. Oh, and Labour MP and wearer of sunglasses so big she's probably vitamin D deficient, Fiona Onasanya, has been sentenced to 3 months in prison due to lying about speeding and texting while driving. I almost wonder if it's now, with all this Brexit stuff, just part of a politician's inbuilt training that they can't be honest about anything anymore. Did Fiona Onasanya straight up lie when asked how fast she was going? Or did she respond, well, it's the ridiculous limits enforced by the EU that mean people everywhere are moving too slow to sustain our economy? Still, based on the debates that she'll be missing between now and April, I can't help but feel we'll see a number of MPs stepping on the gas while watching YouTube and trying to wave down police just to see if they'll be as lucky. Yes, that is all I'm saying on what was just several hours of idiocy on Tuesday. It's so stupid. It's all so stupid. Anyway, welcome to the Partly Political Broadcast podcast. This is not so much a bonus episode as a kind of add-on to the one that came out on Tuesday, as the interview that I was meant to do on Monday for episode 128 didn't happen because my interviewee was sadly unwell. However, she then contacted me on Tuesday and asked if I fancied speaking to her then instead, and I did. So this is technically episode 128B, and if you listen to it very quickly after 128, then it's almost like that one didn't completely go out of date immediately after release. Anyway, thank you for listening. Hope you enjoy, and don't forget to subscribe, review, donate, eat and sleep where you can, be kind to one another, and avoid any scary looking spiders. And there'll be a proper full length episode out next week on Tuesday, as per normal. Wales, the strange stumpy grabby upturned hand at the midriff of the UK, and a beautiful country, well except Newport, of rolling valleys, stunning coastlines and home of all the rain. It's also a place obsessed by rugby, which I think is a great indication of a good people. As you know, for them it's not about whether they win or not, as long as they try. Wales has been having a pretty hard time of things lately, with a number of infrastructure projects due to bring work, power and industry with them failing before they've even started. The latest of these, the Wilfer Newid, a £12 billion nuclear power station, is currently suspended by Hitachi because of the rising construction costs needed to build it. Which, I mean, yeah, it's a nuclear power plant. You can't just make a shack roof for it out of PVC. What did you think was going to happen? Now, with Airbus threatening to leave as well due to Brexit, it could leave a pretty big dent in the country's employment, which is already the lowest in the UK. Add to that an NHS that's constantly failing to meet targets, the loss of an annual £680 million of funds from the EU that's going to disappear after Brexit, and a potential for the Welsh Government to lose some of its devolved powers under May's withdrawal agreement, and it's easy to think that things are looking even more damp and grey than usual. And that's how I feel from an outsider's point of view. You know, someone who regularly gigs in Wales, but that doesn't really remotely qualify me to have a clue how things actually are. I mean, last time I was there, I spent my whole time tweeting pictures of a projector in my Airbnb that was set up just to shine a massive image of the Welsh dragon on the living room wall. So, you know, what do I know? I've had Northern Irish and Scottish politics updates from interviewees on this show several times before, but talking to someone about Welsh politics was long overdue. So this week I spoke to comedian, writer and columnist Eshilt Says. Yeah, I've probably said her name wrong already, despite practicing. She told me about 12 times and I'll try. I'm so sorry, Eshilt. I'm sorry again for that one as well. Anyway, Eshilt has written for the News Quiz, the soon-to-be-aired new sketch show from Ellis James on S4C, as well as writing a regular column for E. Cymro, the only hard copy Welsh language newspaper in Wales. So I asked Eshilt all about what the general political gist is in Wales at the moment, what exactly the difference between the Welsh Assembly and Welsh Government is, and I gave her constant reassurances that there wasn't interference on the line, it was just my awful, useless attempts to do decent Welsh pronunciations. Anyway, I hope you enjoy. Here is Eshilt. Eshilt. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. So does it seem like people in Wales are still pro-Brexit? Because obviously Wales voted, I think it's 52% Brexit, pretty much bang on the UK kind of number. Are Welsh people still pro-Brexit despite all the evidence that it's going to hit Wales pretty hard?
This is such a hard question to answer. Because there were some polls actually out before Christmas that said that that Wales no longer supports Brexit and that it's starting to shift. But to be honest, it's really quite hard to gauge because I think with my social group, for example, I haven't come across anyone who's admitted to voting Leave. So on a social level, and even work-wise, you know, in my line of work and things like that, I haven't met someone who's admitted to it. So it's very hard to gauge on that level. So you're kind of having to go by these polls, and the polls were saying before Christmas that, you know, it was changing and people in Wales were starting to think, oh, you know, if they voted again, they would vote to remain. But then there is an element, I think, you'll have the farming community especially. I mean, a lot of farmers voted to leave, which was quite unprecedented, you know, just because of how much help, financial help they get from the EU. And I don't know, a lot of people I've spoken to have said that maybe some of them now just think, oh, well, let's just get on with it. This whole rhetoric that so many people have of, well, it's happening now, let's just do it and see what happens. I don't know.
Are there specific areas? Because I mean, I can recall a particularly not fun gig that I had at Blackwood Miners Institute. Shout out to Blackwood Miners Institute, where pretty much the entire audience, I think, were angry Leave voters at the time.
It's funny, isn't it? As a stand-up, I think you get a real insight that other people don't get. Because in my stand-up, I tend not to do any kind of political commentary at all. I find that it's safer not to. But you do listen to other comics and they will try and broach it. And you will get a sense of, you know, how that area either voted or what they feel about it now. I think the problem for me is I grew up in Ceredigion, which is a county that voted to stay. I live in the Vale of Glamorgan, and we voted to stay as well. you know, I went to university in Cardiff. Cardiff as a county voted to stay. So for me, I've always moved in Remain circles. So again, you know, my points of reference are still very much Remain. But I think I will put my neck out there, though, and say I think in the main, I think there is a shift. I think there is a shift in Wales. More so because people are starting to realise that Wales might get left behind on certain elements. And I think so many things that have happened in the news recently, things like the Tidal Lagoon project not going ahead, the electrification of the railway in South Wales, things to do with Tata Steel, and you know, so many things are going wrong at the moment, where there's an issue with job losses. And I think that's suddenly now making people think, you know, God, you know, who's actually looking after us in Wales? So if I had to say, there is a shift. I think there is a shift to remain, definitely.
I mean, that's something that I wanted to ask you about with the nuclear power plant and the tidal lagoon stuff. But is there an overall feeling? I mean, and I say this as someone I sort of mentioned to you before we recorded that Wales is so rarely mentioned on news in England. You know, does Wales feel like it's being neglected by the UK government? All these infrastructure projects have been kind of failed or suspended. It doesn't feel like we're hearing Wales's voice on Brexit very much. Is that the feeling, or am I just kind of putting that on?
No, I think you're right. But I think Wales's voice isn't even being heard in Wales, because there is a big debate at the moment about whether or not the media should be devolved and whether we should have an independent media in Wales. Because, you know, we don't really, I mean, have a proper, you know, well, we don't have a daily Welsh newspaper, really. I mean, you've got the Western Mail, for example. That's seen as the national daily newspaper. But more and more, I'm going to say it, I don't think that journalistically it's a very good newspaper. They're too driven by clickbait and stuff these days. You know, it's not enough investigative journalism. It never feels like it has Wales's interests at heart. It'll go after quite easy populist UK-wide stories sometimes. So I just don't feel like there's a paper, especially online or otherwise, that really has that, really goes after that. There has been, though, some development. There's a newspaper, an online newspaper called Nation Cymru, that has started to change that. So it's very like Wales-centric. It's Welsh news for Welsh people. Because, you know, most of the national newspapers, like UK national newspapers, they will have regional versions in Scotland and in Ireland, but you don't in Wales. And so many people will read your Daily Mails and The Sun and The Mirror and stuff like this. But it's English news. And I think that's what drove a lot of people to vote Leave in a way, because they were looking at what was happening in certain areas in England, which had no relevance to what's happening in Wales, but they were just going with what those papers were writing about, you know. And that's hard. It's hard. For me, I've always said that what Wales needs is a good national Welsh tabloid, more so than anything else, you know, to get to those areas of the news that really hit a note with working class people. You just don't have that in Wales. You know, people will just read it from an English perspective.
I mean, are there no sort of Welsh language papers then? Because, I mean, one of the, you know, I've seen S4C quite a few times and watched Completely Confused, as I don't speak Welsh. But you know, what's the kind of voice that's been behind S4C or behind Welsh language publications, or don't they really exist?
Yes, yeah, so you'll have the national news on S4C. They have a few programmes that will go out every day. And to be fair, they're quite balanced news reports. They tend to be quite balanced. And they will go after Welsh interests more than anything else. But you're obviously then just targeting Welsh speakers. And although, you know, there are a lot of Welsh speakers, it's not the biggest part of the population, so you're missing out on, you know, three quarters of the population that way. I personally write a column for the monthly national Welsh language newspaper, but because it's a monthly paper, it's more commentary, and again, you know, you're restricted by just targeting Welsh speakers. So in a way, and I don't know how to position this without sounding a bit elitist about it, but I do feel sometimes that Welsh language, Welsh speakers get a more balanced view on things than non-Welsh speakers, because the non-Welsh speakers will get most of their news from English papers, which is, you know, they're not necessarily going after the Welsh topics, if you see what I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the English papers are poisoning Wales. That's what's happening.
That's your headline.
I'll run with that. That's fine. So what, I mean, one of the things that I have seen in headlines is that the Welsh government are overriding the Assembly on Brexit matters, and some people seem to be upset with that. Now, this is an area that I'm very unclear on as to how it works in terms of devolvement, but what should the Assembly or government be in charge of Brexit from the Welsh people's point of view? How does it all work?
It's a very good question. Shall I first explain what the difference is?
Please do. Yeah.
Welsh Assembly, because I myself sometimes I'll write something and I won't even think about, you know, whether I'm putting Assembly or government down, and even, you know, newspapers will mix them up. To put it in the easiest way possible. So the National Assembly for Wales is the body that represents the interests of Wales. So in a British or an English sense, you're talking about Westminster. So the National Assembly is Westminster, but the Welsh government is the actual government that was formed after an election. So the Welsh government is currently a Labour government. So the Assembly is the body and Welsh government is the ruling party, basically. Does that make sense? So what you're talking about here is that whether the Assembly, so all, you know, all the parties within that body, whether that should override what Welsh government, as in Labour, as the ruling party, are deciding. And it's such an interesting topic, because I personally feel, because all these decisions now are being made from Westminster, it does feel a little bit like the Assembly, maybe they should all come together and really just look after the interests of Wales. Because on a Westminster level, you have this rhetoric at the moment of, you know, we should all come together and support what Theresa May wants to do, you know, for the sake of the country, etc. On a Westminster level, I personally don't agree with that. I think, you know, it needs to be challenged, and I think all the parties should have a role to play in that. But on a Welsh level, I think it's reached a point where we're at such a crucial point where we might lose, you know, a lot of our devolved powers, and, you know, the decisions that we used to be able to make, we might not be able to make anymore. I just think maybe the Assembly should have more of a say as to what happens now.
So in terms of sort of putting Brexit aside for 1 minute, like in terms of things like the NHS, again, that's a constant thing that comes up, that you know, the NHS in Wales is having worse target issues than the NHS in England. But is that then more the fault of the Welsh government's management, or is that due to lack of allocated funding from the UK Westminster government? How, you know, where do you put the blame for that, and where do kind of, you know, are Welsh people angry with how, with their own government, or does the blame kind of get put onto the overall?
It depends on which party you support, I think.
Right, as always. Yeah, right?
Exactly. But for me, I think it's both. It's the fault of both of them. You know, there isn't enough allocated funding, but also I don't think the Welsh government is managing it properly. But you will see the NHS is used as a political tool, though. You know, you'll have Jeremy Corbyn, he'll go on about, you know, the fact that the NHS in Wales, you know, people still see the value of it because obviously, you know, there's a big history of the NHS being established by a Welshman, and, you know, and they're very proud of that. So this they do use it as a political tool, whereas then, you know, the Tories in Westminster will use the figures in Wales to attack the Labour government. But obviously they have some responsibility as well in terms of funding. So it is used a lot as a tool, but personally, yes, I think, you know, it's the fault of both of them.
Right. And so, and is it, I mean, do you think Wales is kind of still very much a Labour country then as well, because it was for many years. But then I know in recent years, obviously, there, some areas went a bit UKIP-y, which was, again, probably down to the English papers. And Plaid Cymru's kind of disappeared a bit. Is that right? I mean, where do you see the kind of future of Welsh politics?
In some places it's still very much Labour. I mean, when you're talking about the industrialised areas of Wales, it is still very much Labour. I mean, in some areas, you know, you could put a potato to stand for an election, you know, for Labour, and they would, you know, it's a shoo-in in some places. It doesn't really matter, you know, who you are as a candidate. If you're a Labour candidate, you'll get in. And that's not by saying potato. I must just. By saying that is in no way making out that the voters, you know, aren't thinking about who they're voting for. It just means that it's so ingrained in them, and you know, they will never vote Tory. That's the point. They will never ever vote Tory because of how they see the Tory government under Margaret Thatcher treated those industrial areas. You know, it just doesn't matter to them. You know, Labour is basically the anti-Tory vote. And I mean, Plaid Cymru, to be fair to them, I don't think they've made the gains that they'd hoped that they would. Having said that, they have made some headway in some of the more industrial areas. And I think someone like Leanne Wood, when she was the leader, she was able to reach out to those industrial areas because, you know, that's where she comes from. And she could talk to them, you know, on a level that they got, actually, you know, we do have another option here. It's not just about Labour, potentially. We do have another option other than the Tories. I don't know what the reason is there. You know, there has been some squabbling internally with Plaid Cymru. So I just don't know. Maybe they just haven't been as focused as they should have been. But
is it anything to do with the... Because, I mean, Leanne Wood was very good on a kind of UK level as well. Whenever she did televised debates, she came across very well. Whereas the new leader, Adam Price, all I've really seen is that quite odd campaign video that he did. I don't know if you've seen that. It looks like a sort of 80s music video. But I don't know. Do you think that he's not quite got the same gravitas as maybe the previous leader?
She was very good at putting Plaid Cymru on a UK level. And again, yeah, because like you said, Wales doesn't get the headlines in England or in Scotland, but with her, we kind of did. And she was quite media friendly and she would stand up to herself. I don't know. I mean, Adam Price still probably needs to prove himself, but he's got a lot of support though. So it'd be interesting to see what he does.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, like you mentioned before about the kind of years of you know, the history is why people wouldn't vote Conservative again. And then that brings me back to kind of the infrastructure projects that have failed recently. Is there then still a lot of animosity, or it must be coming back again towards the Conservative government?
Yes, because I think historically, when you talk about coal mines especially, I think one of the issues that you'll always talk about is that it's not the fact that they were closed down, but that there was no contingency plan. Nothing was put in place for all those people who lost their jobs and those communities that obviously suffered as a result. And it seems that that's what's happening now as well, is that all these projects are being promised. And you know, a lot of them are innovative projects. You know, you're talking about the tidal lagoon and stuff like that. And for me personally, you said about Wilver there, because I never used to be a massive advocate for nuclear power. But then I heard a programme on BBC Radio Cymru a couple of years ago, and they talked to young people on Anglesey about their prospects. And the weight of expectation on this new Wilver plant was huge, because it is such a massive employer. And you're not just talking about, you know, mundane manual work. You're talking about, you know, engineers and scientists and managerial jobs and things like that. And without that, they will leave the island. And it, for me then, I just started to support it purely for that, because they felt so passionate about it. And I thought, well, if this is going to be on their doorstep and they want it, then who are we to say that you can't have it, you know? So for this to happen now, it's desperately sad, and there's nothing in its place. And, you know, we've heard about, you know, job losses with Airbus, and further back with Tata Steel and things like that. This is the problem with Wales constantly since the coal mines. Fine, if there's a reason that something isn't economically viable or environmentally sound, fine. But try and put something else in place. It just feels that, you know, the rug is just pulled out from under our feet in Wales constantly, and nothing's there to help prop us up again. And it's starting to feel now, I think. And I think Brexit is making it worse, because we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what deals we're going to have UK-wide and how that will affect Wales. So when these projects, you know, don't come to fruition, it makes us just a tad nervous, let's say that.
Sure. I mean, and also, is infrastructure kind of the way forward for Welsh industry and jobs? I mean, what else do you think Wales would thrive from people kind of putting into it or working on there? Because like things like the tidal lagoon, for me, just seem to make so much sense to have in Wales because of how the sea is so regularly, you know. I just thought, well, there's low, you know, and wind power and things like that seem to be an obvious one.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as a country, we should be able to produce most of our power from natural resources, you know, from the wind and the tide, and maybe not so much the sun, but yeah, and it just seems ridiculous. And the tidal lagoon project just seemed, not just for Wales, but for the whole of the UK, you know, it was kind of putting us on some kind of platform, showing that, you know, we were leading the way in this type of energy. And I genuinely don't know, like, every question you're asking me, I just want to sound exasperated and just gasp at everything, because, you know, I obviously don't have any of the answers. And it, more and more, the feeling I've had over the last few years is just this thing of, oh God, what next? You know, just give us a break, you know. But yeah, things like the tidal lagoon, I mean, you see other countries that are just managing to push the green energy agenda so much better. I mean, in Wales as well, there doesn't seem to be a proper strategic plan for wind energy, for example. You'll see a couple of sites, you know, crop up here and there, and, you know, and people will complain that they're not producing enough energy, and often you'll drive past them and they're never turning, and you just think, where's the strategy here? You know, wouldn't it be better to just put aside certain sections of land and just go for it, you know, rather than just give a farm, you know, a windmill here and there. You know, I don't know. I'm not an expert. It just feels like it's a bit of a scatter approach rather than really going for it. But again, you know, if we're having to get approval from Westminster and they have different ideas, then, you know, I don't know what the answer is to that. I really don't.
There's so many obstacles in the way. I mean, you're saying you're exasperated. I think the entirety of the UK is exasperated at the moment and fed up. And you know, it's something that I think all the listeners will fully sympathise with too. It's one of the possibly good bits of news. Or well, I'll ask you, but you know, I read that Welsh is no longer being classed as a second language in English medium schools in Wales. Is that a good thing? That must be a good move in terms for the Welsh language anyway.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing because I think the Welsh language now, compared to when I was in school, oh God, I'm not going about, you know, 20 odd years ago. I think it's changed. I think the stigma there has changed a bit because I went to, it wasn't classified as a Welsh high school, but it was seen as the Welsh school in the town. So you'd have, there was an English school, and then if you wanted to study through Welsh, you'd go to this other school, this Welsh school. And but, you know, we were bullied for speaking Welsh, and, you know, we were seen as Welsh nationalists if we spoke Welsh, which, you know, as a child is quite hard to deal with because it's just the language you're used to, you know, it's the language you're brought up on. You didn't choose to speak that language, you know, more so than, you know, anyone who speaks English chose to speak English. So I think that the attitude towards the Welsh language within education has changed a lot. And I think, yes, stopping this classification of it being a second language for certain pupils in English medium schools is important because it helps, again, it's another step in pulling away that stigma. The only thing I would say, though, is you have to be mindful that you will get a range then of abilities. So, for example, you know, if you were a first language French speaker and you were doing GCSEs, then you got someone who was just starting to learn French and they were doing GCSEs as well. I think it's being mindful of the different abilities and how you classify that, because obviously you can't compare someone's ability in a, you know, who's first language Welsh, who's in a Welsh medium school doing GCSE, for example, and then compare that with someone in an English medium school and it's their second language. You know, they're not going to be on the same level. So you obviously still have to have some kind of distinction, I think, because then how do you go on to university and things like that? How will they know what your ability is if you're doing the same course? I don't know. But yeah, in the main, I think it's great because, you know, you calling it a second language, you know, I think has always made it seem a bit second class in a way. So yeah, I think it's great for that.
And that's something I meant to ask you just right at the beginning, actually. It's just, you know, one of the things I've always had a sense of with Wales, just from geeking there lots and sort of going there to do various shows. You know, there's such a, Wales has such a good sense of national pride. Like, do you think that comes above, you know, leavers and remainers and language divisions and things like that? Do you think that Wales will always kind of be united as being Welsh?
There's definitely a feeling, you know, that, yeah, that Welshness is there as a constant, certainly. Because I remember in university, one of my essays, because I was studying Welsh history, and one of my essays was whether you needed to be able to speak Welsh to count yourself as Welsh. And I don't think you do. And I think that's what's quite unique in Wales, is that they can kind of coexist. I mean, obviously, you'll have some fractions. But in the main, there is still that feeling of that sense of national pride. But then having said that, often that comes from feeling like you're being hard done by someone. You know, there's that collective nationality that kind of that comes out of being trodden upon sometimes, you know, because that's all you've got in a way. And that's not a healthy nationality, I don't think. But yeah, in the main, you know, the Six Nations is starting soon, and you know, most people will get behind that, whether they speak Welsh or English, or you know, whether they've moved in, or you know, even my husband, bless him, he came round France when Wales was playing in the Euros, and he started to enjoy that feeling of nationality, because I don't think it has the same stigma as English nationality has, for example, because my husband's English, and he often, you know, looks at Welsh and thinks, oh gosh, you know, it'd be nice if I could feel that same kind of pride without having, you know, some awful connotations that sadly English nationality has, you know. I don't know if you feel like that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But it's like you said in that, you know, whether that's a sort of sad way to look at it, but like, you know, Welsh pride, like you said, it might come from being trodden on, but Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland have suffered at the hands of English over many years, and, you know, or kind of been oppressed by, and British or English pride kind of comes from, you know, the empire and all sorts of awful reasons it stems from. Whereas I feel like there's something a bit more, this sounds horribly patronising, but kind of honest or real about, you know, Scottish, Welsh, and Northern Irish pride. Maybe I'm looking at that because I'm based in London and constantly feel guilty about it. But
well, yeah, and I mean, I've always said this, and I'm probably going to annoy a lot of Welsh speakers who are listening to this now. But you know, and I'm a very proud Welsh speaker, and you know, I support, you know, the drive to get more people to speak it. But I've always said, you know, would we really feel so passionately about it if it really was on a par with English? You know, the reason that we have such a fire in our bellies for it, and you know, that we want to fight for it, is because it's at risk, you know. And I think becoming, if Welsh was just accepted and it was completely equal with English, we would get complacent, surely. We would just take it for granted. And I think that's quite interesting as well. And I'm sure that possibly comes out in kind of your sense of nationalism or whatever. I think you hold on to it and you take pride in it when it's at risk, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, especially, you know, even just looking on social media, the amount of kind of English nationalists who don't know the difference between your and your, you know, I think it's it's evident they take it for granted. And just one last question for you, which is something that I ask all the guests on this podcast, is apart from yourself, obviously, who should listeners check out and read up on and follow online for Welsh politics information? Like, who do you go to? Who do you enjoy reading?
Right. Oh, do you know what? I had to whittle this down quite a lot because there were so many people. So the first person I'd say is Richard Wynne-Jones. He is a professor in Welsh politics, and you'll often find him on English and Welsh TV commentating during elections and things like that. But I really like him. He's quite straight talking. And even though he, you know, his interests lie with Welsh politics, he doesn't revere Welsh politics as, you know, as the blueprint for everything. He'll really criticise it, and you know, and I like that. I like people who are passionate about Wales, but who will criticise it as well. You know, I think that's important for growth and prosperity. So Richard Wynne-Jones, definitely. Then there's a journalist called Eleanor Kresge. She's written quite a bit for The Guardian, and she's done a bit for Channel 4 News as well. Now, she's Welsh, but she doesn't specifically write about Welsh things. But now and again, you know, if a story breaks and it's something relevant to Wales, she will comment on it. And she always has quite insightful things to say. So I would definitely recommend her. Then I mentioned earlier on this online newspaper that's been established called Nation Cymru. Again, just to get a Welsh view on the news that you might not get through mainstream media. And it's quite a balanced view as well. You know, it's not, you know, Wales is great. You know, it's quite a reality check sometimes about what's happening in Wales. Then you've got Elliw Gwawr, and she is BBC Cymru's Westminster correspondent. So she will commentate a lot on what's happening with Welsh MPs in the Commons and things like that. So that's really interesting as well. So you're not just talking about Assembly members. You know, it's kind of the influence or lack of influence that Wales has in Westminster. So she always has very interesting commentary on that.
And I might have to get you. How do you spell her name?
So her name is Elliw, so that's E-L-L-I-W, Gwawr, G-W-A-W-R.
Great, I'm really pleased I asked, thank you.
That's right. She's got two accounts on Twitter. One is for her Westminster correspondent role, and the other one is she bakes, she writes cookery books and stuff. So that's obviously how she distresses after being a Westminster. It's worth following both of her accounts. And then two more. So Roger Scully, he's head of politics at Cardiff University. I really like him. And then someone I think you know, on Twitter, he comes under the Twitter handle of Maidley. I would recommend people follow him on Twitter because whenever Welsh-related news or even English-related news that could have a knock-on effect on Wales but no one's talking about it, he will pull people up on it. And, you know, he gets angry, but it's nice to see other people getting angry about it. And you think, oh, actually, yeah, it's not just me, you know. And he's got a very animated way of explaining Welsh politics to people, and I just love it. So that's my long short list.
Thanks very much to Esylt for the chat. You can find her on Twitter at, and I'm going to spell this, E-S-Y-L-L-T-M-A-I-R, or on Instagram at E-S-Y-L-L-T.S-E-A-R-S. All the other links she mentions will be up on the website later in the week, courtesy of Lydia liner note writer Kat Day. I still need more guests for this show. Feed me guests, not literally, because then I still wouldn't have a guest. I'd have eaten them. You can't just have your guest and eat it. Do send me your suggestions for who to interview, please, or what subjects to interview people about. Do you want more international subjects? Do you want more Brexit nonsense? I'm sure you don't. Who does? More issues that definitely aren't Brexit. That's probably more of a goer. What have I neglected on this show so far or for a while, or what burning injustices should I be taking an audio hose to? Bearing in mind that an audio hose would be useless despite sound waves. Let me know at any of these socials and connect ability stations at Parpolbro on Twitter, the Partly Political Broadcast group on Facebook, the contact page on partlypoliticalbroadcast.co.uk, or email me at partlypoliticalbroadcast@gmail.com. Or you could put your recommendation into the credits of an on-demand TV show, and then when I'm binge-watching it, I won't see it as it disappears into a minimised screen, only for the next episode to start, ensuring no one cares about who worked on what and if anyone has a hilarious surname. Oh, it's so sad. Why no one care about the makeup wrangler or camera upsetter? So sad. So yeah, probably just best to email, isn't it? And that's that. Proper episode again next Tuesday, where I'll probably be telling you about how May responding to the EU saying no to removing the backstop by saying cool, cool, can remove the backstop though please 600 times actually wore them down enough to let her plan through after they ran out of tables to bang their heads on. Please subscribe, donate to the Ko-fi and Patreon sites and review the show, and I'll see you on Tuesday. Bye!
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.